With the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Taylor Hillman.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. I am your host, Taylor Hillman. It looks like it's been a beautiful past couple of days on the coastal areas, but just plain hot in the valley regions. Temperatures toyed with triple digits for the first time in 2018 in most areas. That will really ramp up crop progress as we move forward. It stayed mild on those coastal regions, 70s in most areas. And we should all see a cool-off today and into tomorrow. Valley areas are looking at low 90s today, even cooler than that tomorrow. And coastal regions will be a little bit cloudy and under yesterday's temps as well. The hot valley weather is expected to return, however, into tomorrow and through the weekend. We have a busy show today. Central Valley Project agricultural producers got a little bit of a bump in water allocations, just a little. We will hear about that shortly. Brian German has some information on upcoming meetings. Danielle Leal has some information on the organic industry. And we now know why members of the Freedom Caucus surprised everyone a little bit when they didn't support the House Farm Bill. It has started a little bit of a war of words between two politicians who are both trying to get a farm bill done by the end of the year. So let's get right to today's news. Central Valley Project growers south of the Delta got a little good news on Friday before the holiday weekend. The Bureau of Reclamation announced another increase to the allotment of agricultural water it would deliver in 2018. However, the increase was only 5%. This comes after the State Water Project increased 5% last week as well. The Bureau said that based on continued refinement of hydrologic analysis and other operational factors, the allocation for South of Delta agricultural water service contractors has increased from 40 to 45%. The allocation for municipal and industrial contractors south of the Delta remains at the greater of 75% of their historical use or public health and safety needs. The Bureau added that this allocation update takes into account the information from the California Department of Water Resources May forecasts, as well as continued refinement of their own estimates and capabilities given their current conditions. In addition, they have more certainty regarding the ability to manage temperature in the Sacramento River and meet other regulatory requirements throughout the system. Though adjustments may still need to be made, they are urging contractors to continue to exercise conservative use of this resource. Now here's Brian German.
Registration is open for the annual Viticulture Research Roadshow and Educational Wine Tasting, which will be taking place next week on Wednesday, June 6th at the FEOC Nielsen Conference Center in Fresno. The symposium allows all grape growers an opportunity to gain firsthand information from researchers about the work being done for and in the San Joaquin Valley. The roadshow is hosted by the San Joaquin Valley Wine Growers Association and UC Cooperative Extension, along with support from the California Sustainable Wine Growing Alliance. The symposium will begin at 1 p.m. with a presentation on phylloxera from Carl Lund, UC Cooperative Extension Viticulture Advisor from Madera County. Other topics of discussion include nematodes, potassium use and needs in grapes, along with micronutrient use and symptoms of deficiencies. The annual Viticulture Research Roadshow and Educational Wine Tasting is happening Wednesday, June 6th in Fresno. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
In national headlines, one of the major reasons the House Farm Bill was defeated was because members of the Freedom Caucus decided not to support the bill last minute. Well, it turns out that Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley said there are loopholes in subsidies for growers where non-agricultural groups can claim available monies. Claims are that the House Farm Bill had no correction for those or any payment limitations. House Ag Chair Michael Conaway says that's not true. An amendment that would address those limits on funds failed during discussions, which was an amendment that was put through by the Freedom Caucus. There is now a war of words between Conaway and Grassley. Grassley said over Twitter that Conaway should have to tell farmers why he's wrong for wanting to limit farm subsidies to farmers and not Wall Street bankers living high on the hog. Farm subsidies meant as a safety net for farmers with dirt under their nails. Grassley added that he would use the Senate version of the Farm Bill to close those loopholes. Another consolidation is official, and it strengthens a dangerous precedent for agriculture. The U.S. Department of Justice approved Bayer's $62.5 billion acquisition of Monsanto. The deal will consolidate control of more than a quarter of the world's seed and pesticides market and create the largest seed and crop chemicals company in the world. This is the latest in a line of mergers that have officially been approved that could change the agriculture landscape. National Farmers Union President Roger Johnson said these mergers cost the producer in the long run.
Bayer's acquisition of Monsanto culminates the latest and most disturbing round of consolidation amongst the handful of companies that control both U.S. and global agricultural markets. Three massive companies now control the markets that supply agricultural inputs like seeds, traits, and chemicals. This extreme consolidation drives up costs for farmers, and it limits their choice of products in the marketplace. It also reduces the incentive for the remaining agricultural input giants to compete and to innovate through research and development. While we appreciate the significant divestitures agreed to as a part of this approval, Farmers Union condemns DOJ's continued rubber stamping of mergers in the food and agriculture arena. We will now focus our efforts on ensuring that the promises made by Bayer and Monsanto throughout this approval process are kept. The company must continue to increase the productivity of American family farmers by delivering localized solutions in seeds, traits, and crop chemical innovation.
This is Farm City News Day by Agnet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from around the state and the nation at our website, agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Agnet West's Farm City News Day. More agriculture news for you now.
According to the California Department of Food and Agriculture, California is the primary driver of growth in U.S. organic farming. The USDA recently withdrew its organic livestock and checkoffs rule, which signals that the agency likely won't be setting any higher standards for the organic seal. Laura Baca, CEO of the Organic Trade Association, says it's up to the industry now to take over from here. At the Organic Trade Association's recent annual policy conference, Baca said the USDA has gone as far as it's willing to go with this and, quote, "It's a real watershed moment for the industry. This is the first time we are seeing the market impacted." The Hagstrom report says Baca was referring to a flattening in growth of the organic egg and dairy sales. The livestock and poultry requirements would have imposed outdoor living requirements for animals involved in dairy and egg production. That rule has since been withdrawn by USDA. At the same time, organic egg companies have now labeled their eggs as pasture-raised and consumers have responded. Baca says the dairy market is a little more complicated, though. There's been an oversupply of organic milk at the same time that consumers are also turning to more plant-based protein. Baca says the OTA is continuing with this lawsuit against the USDA for withdrawing that livestock and poultry rule. I'm Danielle Leal, Agnet West Radio Network.
Well, in today's livestock news, USDA's latest cattle on feed report indicates the number of cattle and calves on feed for the slaughter market in the U.S. at 11.6 million head as of May 1. That's 5% above May 1 of last year. Placements in feedlots during April were down 8% from last year, but marketings of fed cattle during April were 6% higher than last year. And according to a story from Rod Bain, this May 1st report on cattle in feedlots perhaps indicates some trends that may not stand out from the initial numbers.
There were some interesting numbers coming out of the Agriculture Department's latest cattle on feed report. Take, for instance, 11.6 million head of cattle in feedlots as of May 1st. That's up 5% from 1 year ago. And according to USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagham, that's the second largest May 1st inventory on record.
We are actually looking at an increasing inventory of cattle, so there is a bigger pool of calves which were born last year, which are available for placement this year. You also have dry conditions in a number of states, which has probably resulted in a fair number of animals which might have been on grass and on forage in the southern plains being placed in feedlots instead.
Contrast that with cattle placements in feedlots, down 8% year over year.
It does seem like a very sharp decline, but we do have to remember that we are coming off of a very high number last year. That 1.85 million head that were placed in April 2017 was actually the second highest for the month since the series began.
With all but the two highest weight categories for cattle placed in feedlots down from the previous year. However, in terms of April marketings of fed cattle, there was a 6% increase from 2017.
We placed a lot of animals during the last quarter of 2017 and into 2018. Those animals are ready. They're coming out of the feedlots. They're going to the back plants. And to some extent, that's reflected in the fact that we have those higher numbers.
But digging deeper into recent inventory, placement, and marketing trends, Shagum offers this observation.
One of the main takeaways is in the coming months, we're going to have a lot of cattle coming out of the feedlots, and diminishing supplies of cattle available for placement feedlots would tend to imply probably starting to move towards smaller placement numbers.
He adds that the year-over-year decline in lower-weight cattle placed in feedlots also implies
that we are looking at some tighter supplies of calves available for placement.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. And a reminder, the U.S. Meat Export Federation is excited about Global Politics of Food Session. That's what the topic will be for the World Meat Congress in Dallas, Texas. It's taking place this week, May 30th through June 1st. As a matter of fact, folks from across the country and across the world will be on hand. The theme this year is Trusting in Trade. It's the first time in history, the more than 20-year-old event, that it's being held in the U.S. So again, it starts today, runs through June 1 in Dallas, Texas. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Evergreiner is next.
You know, a farmer can wait for the right weather to plant most of his row crops. I mean, if it's too wet, wait for a dry run. If it's too dry, wait for a good rain. But there are crops that cannot be timed that way. Tree crops. There's peaches, apples, pears, and several others, and nut trees. In just about every southern state, from California to Florida, farmers can irrigate if the weather is dry. But the progress of the crop is up to the tree itself. That doesn't mean a grower doesn't have to work his trees. There's fertilizer. There's a time to fertilize. And even more important, the insect control. This must be done when needed. So, when everything is taken into consideration, trees that produce an edible crop require just about as much time as any other crop. And that's AgriView for today. Everett Greiner, AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from around the state and the nation at our website, agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West's Farm City News Day. More agriculture news for you now.
We food shoppers have had 2 years in a row of falling average grocery store food prices, but that string could snap this year.
We're expecting to pay 1.5% more overall in 2018 than we did in 2017.
Agriculture Department food price economist Anne Marie Coons. Now, yes, we are seeing farm level and wholesale prices for many commodities falling, some of them down below a year ago, and Coons says,
this does trickle through to the retail level, but there are many other factors that come into play to that price we're paying at the grocery store.
And this year, the big factor,
the costs associated with transportation in general, whether it's because of the increase in oil prices or increases in trucking rates, have become more expensive in 2018.
This week, prices for diesel fuel, for example, are almost 30% higher than this time a year ago. So right now, at least, Coons sees only 4 food categories that even have a chance of selling for less than in 2017. That's pork, fats, and oils. That includes salad dressings and butter, processed fruits and vegetables, and non-alcoholic beverages. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
Why you'll want to give extra special attention to flowers today. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Today is National Water a Flower Day, and while it's still unknown who invented or created this day, it's a great reminder to pay some extra special attention to some of the Earth's most beautiful creations. The flower is the reproductive part of a plant which produces seeds. Plants that produce flowers and fruit are called angiosperms. There are nearly 300,000 species of angiosperms, and their flowers and fruits may vary significantly. Fruits and flowers are among the most useful features for identifying the plant species. National Water a Flower Day is a yearly reminder to show our flowers how much we appreciate them for their beautiful colors, their fragrant blossoms, and their medicinal or sometimes lethal properties. I'm Kathy Eisen for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West, and welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook in under 3 minutes or less from an award-winning chef. I'm your host with the most. Let's get started. So special thanks to all of the wonderful fans and patrons who came out to the Morgan Hill Mushroom Mardi Gras, the 39th annual Morgan Hill Mushroom Mardi Gras last week. It was such an honor and a pleasure to be your chef, and I'm glad that I get to share those recipes with you today here on the California Kitchen. This is my recipe for mushroom mole. Let's get started. So the very first thing we need to do is we need to get some beef stock. Now, if you want to do the vegan or vegetarian style of this, that's totally okay. You're going to have to use vegetable stock in lieu of beef stock. So I'm going to take 2 quarts of beef stock. I'm going to take 3 cups of button mushrooms. Now, if you don't have button mushrooms, you can use whatever mushrooms you have, but I like to use button mushrooms because we're actually going to blend them into our mole. I'm also going to use 1 cup of Japanese chilies, the little mini, tiny little dry chili pods. Make sure you take all the seeds out of those. Very important. And I'm also going to use 1 cup of our New Mexican chilies. Now, New Mexican chilies do 2 things. They give a really, really great flavor, and they also give a great color to this mole that we're going to do here. I'm going to put them into my pressure cooker, and the very next step is not difficult, but what it is it's a little bit different because of the fact that we're not adding any onion or any tomato to this mole, we have to add other flavors to this as well. So what I'm going to be actually using is I'm going to be using 5 to 6 prunes. Now, I know you're probably thinking, Chef, I don't like prunes. I promise you, prunes have a great aftertaste in mole, and the flavor is very, very prevalent to having authentic mole. So we want to make sure to put the prunes in there as well. I'm going to add to this as well 1.5 cups of roasted or even raw almonds. Very important that we put the almonds in there because this is going to be a major texture for us. And the last 2 ingredients I'm going to put in is our peanut butter. And with peanut butter, I like to use at least 1 cup of peanut butter. If you want this to be a little bit sweeter, you could add 1/2 cup more, but no more than that. Put the pressure on your pressure cooker, the pressure cap on the pressure cooker, and go ahead and let it cook for 20 to 25 minutes. Carefully remove your pressure cooker once it's hit for 25 minutes at full pressure. Make sure to always wet the top of the pressure cap. That way it comes off real easy. And last but not least, you're going to add in your chocolate, which I like to use 1 cup of semi-sweet chocolate. Blend and thicken with a little bit of xanthan gum. About 1 tablespoon of xanthan gum would be more than enough for this. And enjoy. I'm Albert J. Hernandez. You can call me the Untamed Chef for AgNet West.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. I'm Taylor Hillman. In today's interview segment, the U.S. beef to China hurdle was cleared last year and hasn't been included in any of the recent tariff talks. ZimCom's Jamie Johansson talked to AllFlex Livestock Intelligence about the market and where things could go.
We are here at the 2018 One AllTech Ideas Conference, and we're going to be talking about beef with Ian, and the Chinese borders are not open. So basically, you're going to be talking to or are talking to AllTech attendees here at this event about what now. So go ahead and introduce yourself first.
Thanks very much. My name is Ian Lahiff, and I'm based in China leading up operations over there. It's a huge opportunity. You know, consumption of beef in the Western markets is actually going down slowly. It's fairly flat. In China, consumption is almost doubling over the last 10 to 15 years. So it's a huge opportunity. To put it in context, in 2003, China only imported 60,000 tons of beef. In 2017, it was close to 700,000. And by 2020, it could be 1.4 million tons of beef. So it's huge, huge numbers and a huge opportunity. Obviously, the big news came in 2017. So after 14 years, US beef was finally back on the menu in China. And there was a lot of excitement over that, but again, we're failing to see the demand, or we're failing to see the volumes grow. And I guess I'll be talking about and describing maybe some of the challenges and opportunities thereafter for U.S. beef producers.
I remember where I was in 2003 because I'm a U.S. beef producer. So I remember when that BSE scare hit, or not scare, but when it was discovered, I remember where I was on the farm and my dad and I having that conversation and me going, well, what is this? I remember I just graduated high school. And so fast forward to 14 years later, what does this mean for the U.S. beef producer?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, I'm from Ireland and we had a similar issue with our beef. So we can certainly share the challenges. I mean, I remember not being allowed to go to school. So I had a very similar experience. At the time, the U.S. beef made up half of China's beef imports. And obviously, over the 14 years, you know, there's been a lack of branding and marketing. You know, without access, you can't invest too much. And in that period, obviously, beef consumption has surged. And beef has been coming in primarily from two sources, one being South America, and maybe Brazil and Uruguay leading the way in that, and that'd be the lower price, and the higher end is being covered by Australia and New Zealand. And you know, Australia's premium offering is all based around, say, grass-fed Wagyu and all of this kind of green message. And the US message is slightly different. You know, it's about a grain-fed, it's about the quality, carcass quality, and the meat quality system that the U.S. has so excellently built and maintained over the years. So there's going to be a challenge to communicate and educate both your customers, but also these new channels. You know, your e-commerce channels, your Alibaba, your JD. These are becoming major beef buyers and major influencers. So I think there's an educational challenge, but there's also then a price point challenge. It's a genuine challenge for US producers. China's been used to a diet of Brazilian and Australian beef coming in by the container at a, you know, far maybe 20-30% cheaper than anything you could buy out of the US, never mind your more prime grades. So you know, there's a challenge there to develop and restructure that value proposition in the market. But on the other hand, you know, Chinese consumers have more available income, and price sensitivity maybe isn't what it was in 2003. So there's a strong message in China which is called the Chinese Dream, which is almost the Chinese version of the American Dream. And part of that is, you know, eating top class, world-class beef. You know, why shouldn't the Chinese consumer's view is, I want the best, and if the best happens to come from the US, well, hey, I'm willing to pay for it. So you know, there's a principle there of in China of, you know, you pay for value. You can't, you know, there's no shortcut there, but it's a matter of developing the right partnerships so that you can bring that value right through to the consumers.
You talked about that value point and how that's changing because of the change of the Chinese consumer. So let's talk about their taste buds. You know, what are they wanting? What are they trending towards now in 2018, which is kind of different than what the U.S. is trending?
Yeah, very different, and it's a great question. The first thing I think is it's a very clear generation divide. So the older generations in China, you know, they didn't buy much meat in general, and when they bought, it was probably pork is the cheapest meat in the market. And even if they were buying beef, they'd probably buy a block of any general cut and chop it up and mix it in with their vegetables over, and you get the taste of meat, but you're actually consuming very little beef. Whereas the younger generation, they don't cook as much as the elderly. They eat out a lot and they order in, and their preferences are, there's an amazing study, when they eat out, beef is their top choice of meat. So in a country where pork is king, when you look at the younger consumers, when they eat out, they'll choose 26% of the time, that's the data saying, they'll go for beef. And it's a lot, yeah, so it's an amazing opportunity. But how are they consuming this beef? And then we're coming into how the diets are changing in China. And part of it is in the form of a teppanyaki type on like Japanese or Korean type cuisine, where it's cooked in front. So you come into a restaurant, you sit around, and the chef comes in and cooks it up.
The whole Korean barbecue. Yeah, the barbecue, all thing.
That. Okay. So there's a lot of that. And again, you know, the requirements for quality there aren't as high because you're, you know, heavily seasoned. So, you know, they'll get value out of lots of different cuts. And the other thing is hot pot. So hot pot, either Mongolian hot pot or Sichuan hot pot. There's an amazing example of a hot pot from a small place in Yunnan in the southwest of China. Had barely been heard of 3 years ago. And now in Shanghai, one city, there are 2,500 stores selling this particular type of hot pot. And each store uses one head of cattle per day. So that's for one city, for one chain of or type of beef consumption, that's 2,500 head. So, you know, China's a real headache of how they're going to find that kind of supply. And that beef is very, very, they're using a local breed and it's, you know, doesn't have the marbling or any of the qualities of the US beef. But also says, you know, you don't need to maybe be at the premium right up there competing with your Japanese Wagyu or whatever, maybe, you know, getting into the young Chinese trends of what they're eating and finding the right genetics and the right nutrition at the right value point. I think that's what the U.S. Producers should be looking at.
As we, you know, talk U.S. politics, for what does the discussions that we've been having recently with tariffs in China, how does that impact the beef industry?
It's fairly significant impact. First thing is it comes obviously at a sensitive time where some of the first shipments have come through and now there's a little bit of momentum building. This tariff affects confidence. There's a very famous picture that's been going around the Chinese social media of a shipment of sorghum from the US turning around. So it was on, there were five containers of sorghum on the way from the US to China. Three of them turned around and two of them were redirected. So I think there's a fear amongst the people in the beef business that something similar might happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fear is when the relationship between the two countries isn't so good, you know, the Chinese mightn't ban US beef, but it might be sitting in the port for a while.
This is Farm City Newsday by Agnet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Agnet West's Farm City Newsday. More agriculture news for you now.
The Citrus Research Board and UC Cooperative Extension are hosting a series of educational seminars for citrus growers coming up in June. The seminars will take place on Tuesday, June 26th in Palm Desert, Wednesday, June 27th in Santa Paula, and Thursday, June 28th in Exeter. Director of Communications for the CRB, Carolina Evangelo, noted some of the topics that will be addressed at the seminars.
The constant at all three seminars will be Dr. Beth Grafton Cardwell. She'll be giving us an ACP Asian citrus psyllid and Wang Long Bing HLB update. She'll be touching on quarantine zones and giving an update on the bactericides that are available under the new Section 18 that just passed. Jim Cranny from California Citrus Quality Council will also be on the program talking about the work of the CCQC and how research that much of it the CRB funds drives the program and what their program does in terms of their impact on trade.
I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
Phytophthora in strawberries needs to be caught early, and there are some tools available to help growers. Cal Poly's Dr. Kelly Ivers says there is an option for growers who identify Phytophthora in their strawberry rows.
Right, and the one thing about Phytophthora crown rot is that you can actually apply a fungicide through the drip, and it's effective. In comparison to other soil-borne diseases like verticillium or macrophemina, there's not much you can do because nothing works. No chemistries really work very well, drip applied or foliar applied. But if you can confirm that you have Phytophthora, you still have some tools that can keep the plant alive.
Ivers said the key is to catching it early, and there is a quicker tool to help growers do that.
Yeah, so it's sold. They're about $5 each. A company called Agdia sells them, and they're strip tests. So they look just almost like a pregnancy test. They're a dipstick, and you grind up the plant, and you put it in the buffer, and then within 5 to 10 minutes, you'll get the results. And it can be really helpful than having to wait a whole week or longer for a diagnosis.
Now recapping today's top stories. Central Valley Project growers south of the Delta got a little good news on Friday before the holiday weekend. The Bureau of Reclamation announced another increase to the allotment of agricultural water it would deliver in 2018. However, the increase was only 5%. This comes after the State Water Project increased 5% last week as well. In national headlines, one of the major reasons the House Farm Bill was defeated was because members of the Freedom Caucus decided not to support the bill last minute. Well, it turns out that Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley said there are loopholes in subsidies for growers where non-agricultural groups can claim available monies. Claims are that the House Farm Bill had no correction for those or any payment limitations. House Ag Chair Michael Conaway says that's not true. An amendment that would address those limits on funds failed during discussions, which was an amendment that was put through by the Freedom Caucus.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can follow Agnet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgnetWest. Follow Brian German with @BrianAgnetWest, Danielle Leal with @DLealAgnetWest, and Taylor Hillman with @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by Agnet West.